this is Brock, and you are listening to the Sprocket Podcast. We are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Brandon Rhodes. We're broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
And we are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally, with a global perspective, and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
We're covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, alternative transportation, arts, culture, communications, the internet, technology, various miscellaneous.
Yeah, and tonight, bicycle touring. I want to welcome Russ, is it Roca? Yeah, and Laura Crawford, and they are professional bicycle tourists, I guess, is probably the best way to put it, right? You guys, you've spent, was it the last 2 years?
The last year and a half.
Okay, yeah, so... Yeah, we've got them in the studio tonight with us, and they'll be sharing some stories. Before we launch into it, we should let you know we do have some ways for you to get in touch with us on the internet. Our email address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com if you would like to send us a line. And you can call us and leave us a voicemail. It's 503-847-9774. So, we should probably jump right into it.
That's right.
The thing I was thinking of, trying to remember where it was that I first heard about the Path Less Pedaled website, we were reading the Bike Portland blog, and it was Bikecraft when I first heard about the bicycle mustaches that Laura makes.
Yes.
And so that was kind of exciting. What is a bicycle mustache? Maybe for people who haven't seen it. You know what? I just realized. Hang on here.
You also skipped off on drinking the beer, and you didn't turn on their mics. I don't
think. That would be my mistake. So that was me trying to move the mic closer to Laura's face when in reality it wasn't actually even on. So just starting again, tell us about
this.
This is
why you don't do things live. Right?
That's right. Exactly. Well, we'll work up to it. So a head badge goes on the front of your bicycle, and you make the mustached version of that.
Yes, I do a lot of custom head badges, and the bike mustache is just something for people that like to have a little bit of fun, get a little bit silly, and you know, everybody needs to laugh.
It gives you some flair,
exactly,
some personality.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's a, you know, copper handcrafted mustache.
That's pretty fantastic.
People ask you which bike is yours. Oh, it's the one with the mustache.
It's the one with the mustache.
Right.
You got it.
Yeah. Have you seen any out and around, kind of apart from the places that you're selling these?
I've seen two of them.
Nice.
Out in the wild. one of them was actually really funny. It was some readers of our site, and she had bought one as a gift for her husband, and she sent me an email, and she was like, you know, this is the, I'm so excited about this, and I'm attaching a photo of my husband so that you know why, and he had the exact same mustache. And so when we rolled into Austin, we met them in person, got to
nice.
See his mustache and the mustache on the bike.
I was thinking Austin would be the sort of place where you would find the mustached man, I'm sure.
Yes.
It's kind of it's been the grand renaissance of all things, yeah, just like the
mustaches are in.
Right, with milkshake drinking and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So anyways, bikeportland.org, and courtesy of Jonathan Moss, the general editor and proprietor of that fine establishment, he hooked us up with these fellows. So, fellows and ladies and yes,
good folks.
So, anyways, we should just jump right into it.
We should pour drinks.
Maybe I could enlist.
I have my priorities here.
Well, we're pouring Hopworks beer, and Hopworks is a brewery local to Portland, Oregon. And I went down there earlier today by my bicycle through the growler jugs into the buckets, and we got the 7-grain stout and the IPA. So, do either of you have preferences on which one you would like, or which one you would like first?
I'm actually an IPA person.
There we go. All right. Well,
and I'm a dark beer drinker, so
well,
you,
in that
you
case,
nailed it on the head.
You nailed it both.
Right
there. There you are, sir.
And this is
it's like you read our minds.
This is an important moment in the history of this podcast because this is the first time Brock will be drinking something nice.
It's true. Yeah. More often than not, I'll go to the corner store and I'll get something in the line of a malt liquor or a cheap beer. And
last week you had what, like, clam juice in Budweiser?
It was the Budweiser Chelada, yeah, which is not, I don't recommend it as an often, you know, something you have all the time. So, yeah, it was it was unique and interesting, but I don't recommend it. I don't necessarily recommend it. So, yeah. Anyways, Hopworks beer, and so we'll be enjoying that for the duration of our conversation. And we'll give you a little bit of what the experience was like when it's all said and done. So you guys began in 2009.
Yep.
Is that so? Maybe I was just thinking for your origin stories. I wanted to hear a little bit about the scope of your ambitions at that time and what led you toward the decision to kind of live on the road.
Well, we've done a lot of bike touring over, you know, for the last several years, and we'd go off on short trips and, you know, sort of any amount of time that I could take off of my job that I had at the time. And eventually, you know, we'd go out, we'd come back, we'd get really depressed when we came back. And we started thinking, you know, why the heck are we coming back? You know, what would happen if we just kept going?
Yeah.
And, you know, once that seed gets planted in your head, it's really kind of hard to ignore. And then, you know, as fate would have it, I got laid off. And so when we started seeing that that was coming, we just started saving money and getting rid of stuff. And
so you were able to see it coming. It was kind of a...
Yeah, I saw it coming for about 3 months.
It wasn't just like a happy Friday that turned into a sad Friday.
No, it was a very long and grueling couple of months. Okay. But yeah, no, it was nice to have the advance notice,
yeah,
so to speak, so that we could save and do some planning.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Nice. And you guys are both from Long Beach, is that right?
Yeah, we've been living in Long Beach for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah. I actually grew up in Oregon, but...
Oh, okay. Which part?
Corvallis.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. So were you a Beavers fan then, or...?
Well, I think anybody that lives in Corvallis is a Beavers fan
they
by kind default.
Of have to be, by default, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And so you guys had done trips before, but you had decided to just kind of pull the ripcord on the whole normal living thing and just jump right out. Did you guys have any inspirational figures? Like, was anybody that had done it before? That
there's quite a few. One of the real like kind of early bike touring formative moments was I found an old copy of Miles from Nowhere at
used
bookstore.
That's a fantastic book.
Yeah, it's just like classic seminal bike touring text, if there can be such a thing.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, it's this woman Barbara Savage and her husband that ended up doing a around the world bicycle tour. And what was really inspiring and compelling about it was up until the first day that they left on their tour, the most she'd ever ridden in one stretch was 15 miles.
Wow.
So I read that and I was like, well, wow. I can ride 15 miles.
Yeah. You just got to work into it from there.
No kidding.
Yeah, and that was a great book because it made it seem really accessible. You know, a lot of people see bike touring as like this grueling physical activity, which it can be, but you can, you know, like when we finally did this trip, we wanted it to be kind of enjoyable and experiential. You know, the purpose of the trip wasn't to beat ourselves up physically, but to really explore the country.
Sure. Yeah. That was actually something I think I was going to ask later, but maybe we should just talk about it now. Like, you guys had talked about taking an intentionally slow and meandering pace. So what, you say you didn't want to hurt yourself. You didn't want to like go in and sprain all your muscles at once. So,
well, we did a lot of tours, you know, before we had this open-ended time, and it always felt like a rush. You know, you had to bang out the miles because you only had a certain number of days to accomplish things. And during those short tours, we always felt like we were missing something. You know, we'd meet an interesting person and possibly have this great encounter, but you know, we're running on a clock, so we couldn't stop. Or we'd see this cute little restaurant that we'd want to eat at, but, you know, we have to bang out 30 miles because we only have 4 days off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we sort of, you know, when we knew that, you know, I got laid off, Russ had been self-employed beforehand, we could just go for, you know, as long as we wanted to, as long as the money held out, there was no reason for us to rush it. You know?
Right.
Just take it nice and slow, do whatever we wanted to do. And that sort of freedom was really amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like the big difference between vacationing and traveling, too. Mm-hmm. You know, vacationing, there's usually a ticking time clock in the back of your head. And traveling, right, you let yourself open to serendipity and chance encounters.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And being able to just chase down those paths. Like, I did a little bit of hosteling in New Zealand, and mm-hmm. the open-endedness of that, instead of like, oh, well, I want to get here and here. And then right. you know, I got the halfway point and realized, oh, crud, I really do want to get there, there, and there. And it really started constricting the ability to just be where you're at and change your mind.
Right.
Yeah. And then my wife, Adele, who's sitting in the room, but she's not on mic. She's in the background. So you'll have to holler if you have anything to add.
Just scream.
No, we took a trip down the West Coast, and that was our first big, long push for bicycle touring.
Cool.
And we did that in 2009. But yeah, we had a ticket that we had booked at the end, and so mm-hmm. we knew that if we had, like, if we even had a flat tire, like we would be screwed, and there would be no recourse, you know. So
yeah, we did one trip a couple of years ago, and we had I think it was like 4 or 5 days, and we had it was right after New Year's, so I had booked this hotel, and it was a nice hotel, and I thought, you know, this is perfect. It'll be, you know, a great way to kick off the year, you know, whatever. And we took off, and we were supposed to ride, like, I don't know, 50 miles or something that day. And we sort of dilly-dallied. We were taking our time, went through a couple of cute towns, stopped and had lunch, took lots of photos. We were having a great time until the sun started going down, and we sort of forgot, you know, that in January, you know, it gets dark at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
So at, you know, 3:30, we were like, you know, still 15, 20 miles away thinking, right. You know, crap, you know, what are we supposed to do? I've got this reservation at this hotel, you know, and it was one of those things where if we hadn't had that reservation, we would have just stayed in town there. But because we did, you know, we ended up, talking to the waitress at the restaurant where we stopped to have dinner, and her son, we paid him to drive us in his pickup truck, you know, down to the hotel.
You
and, you know, it was one of those, we made it, but we also thought, you know, this was silly. Like, you right. know, we don't ever want to be in this experience again where you have to get to someplace just because you have it booked. So now, yeah. you know, the flip side of that is we're almost phobic of booking a return.
And we're pathological anti-planners.
Yeah, it's a great luxury to have, to have time on your hands. And that's the sort of thing that, I mean, if you were working your normal jobs, that would be really difficult to have. And you'd always have the impending return to work coming back to you. So, well, good work. Congratulations.
And
thanks for doing it. It's the sort of thing I think that probably a lot more people would like to do, but probably are either afraid of the X factors of maybe not being able to find another job or that sort of thing. Yeah, so you guys have been working kind of in the interim, right? Like you've done some photography, Russ, and of course the metal work that you've done, Laura.
Yeah.
I was going to call it handicrafts, but that's a terrible thing to say about what she does. It's much more beautiful than that. So
yeah, while we were traveling, I carried you know, a laptop, computer, lights, strobes. At one point, I had a softbox and light stand. And, you know, my intent was to do food photography and product photography and portrait photography while we were traveling to kind of, you know, make the trip sustainable. And it worked out to some extent. Like we did, and we had a relationship with Clean Canteen, and we're doing product photography for them while we were traveling. The food photography didn't really pan out because it was hard to establish those relationships when you're in town for like 2 or 3 days.
Right.
But I did manage to shoot some family portraits with some readers that we stayed with along the way.
Very nice.
It was interesting because when we left, we figured, you know, Russ, here he is, he's offering a service. It's going to be easier to find people that would be interested in the service.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I create a product, and sometimes it's hard to find, you know, a market for a product. So we figured it would be easier for Russ to be making money on the road, and it turned out to be absolutely the reverse because
really?
I didn't have to go into a town and make a relationship with somebody because it's all – a lot of it is through the internet. And so
right.
you know, I have this longstanding – you know, I have a website that's been up for – you know, many years and, you know, a lot of sort of followers that way. And then through the website, through the pathlesspedal.com.
Okay. So pathlesspedal.com is where you would go to find the bike mustaches and that sort of thing.
Well, that's our touring website.
Yeah.
But the, you know, we have so many folks that follow us there that, you know, it sort of worked out.
Yeah.
But
the other thing I remember seeing on the website was you guys have a fantastic photo book, right? There was kind of a compilation of different shots you'd taken.
Yeah, we had we've got a calendar for sale now, and we also have an ebook, which is kind of like a gear guide.
Sure.
We haven't quite put together the mother of all photo books yet, because I'm still going through about, I don't know, 700 gigs of images.
Yeah.
But we have plans to put together like a nice kind of coffee table bike touring book.
Okay.
Not just pictures of us, but different, you know, folks that we've met, interspliced with like vignettes and stories of, you know, kind of the adventures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you storing all those photos? Are you carrying a little hard drive with you, or have you bought some server space that you're piling them up?
I'm carrying two hard drives.
Oh, that's awesome. That's heavy.
I have about two terabytes. I was looking at cloud servers, but I mean, it was so far and few between that I could find the fast connection. It would take like days literally to upload the gigs of information.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. We've had a few conversations. We still have yet to really dig into it, I think, with probably the depth it deserves. But just the idea of kind of the warring ideas of simplicity and technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And really to survive today with the things that we want to do and the access to media that we want to have. And as a photographer or anything else, even entertainment, I would imagine, you know, like if you want to take a movie along with you, as you did on your first bike trip, right? Yeah, which I think that's a great idea myself. It's interesting to kind of weigh that out and see like you know, how do I want to simplify, how do I want to have the more pared down existence, and how do I want to stay technologically put together,
right?
So have you guys had that distinction at all, or
our lives are simplified in terms of our living stuff. You know, we had the camping gear and a little cook stove, but it was complicated by the fact we wanted it to work. Like when we left, we left each with about 170 pounds of gear.
Okay.
I had about 30 pounds of non-essential to survival gear, which includes the camera, the hard drive, you know, light stand, all that stuff.
Yeah.
We slowly pared it down, but I mean, it was stuff that kind of, enabled our trip to happen.
Right.
Wow.
So
yeah. When I had, I carried along with me what I called my portable studio, and it was basically a tool roll with all of my hand tools for working with metal, and then sheet metal and, you know, chemical patinas and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, there's no way that I would have been able to do anything without taking that stuff along. But, you know, we would joke because I was literally carrying a bag of hammers.
What is a chemical patina, just for those who might not know?
It's
such as myself.
It's the stuff you mix with hot water, and it's I use a liver of sulfur, so it smells like rotten eggs, which is just really lovely. But it turns metal, it darkens metal, so it would turn like a silver, like a dark gray or a black, and it turns copper, that sort of dark, you know, brown color.
Yeah.
So.
Nice, nice. Yeah. And that's all stuff you can do then on the road anywhere you want, along with your bag of hammers.
Right. So
that's pretty exciting. How many pannier bags or just attachments to your bicycle did you need?
What's the rig?
We were running four panniers, a handlebar bag, and a duffel on the back.
Okay.
So I guess that would be six bags.
There you go. That's impressive. And you said about, what, you started out with 170 pounds?
It was 170 with the bike. And then by the end of it, you know, after winter, we shipped back about 20 pounds of winter gear. Mm-hmm. So that cut out, you know, a fair amount. And I think we were down to about 100, including the bike, at the end of our trip.
Yeah.
Very nice. That's not bad. I'm trying to think of, like, on the bicycle tours that we've done, how much weight we've carried. I don't think I've ever weighed them, just because I'm scared to know.
Yeah.
I'd rather not, almost. It's probably easier mentally for me. But that's it's interesting just to have the paring down. I know the winter gear is probably a huge thing, just because there's a lot of things that you'd never use in summer that you desperately need in winter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
and it's not necessarily heavy, but it's bulky. It takes up a lot of space, you know. And we went through 2 months of sub-freezing temperatures at night, so there's no way that I would have done that without, you know, three wool sweaters and a down jacket and, you know, the big heavy sleeping bag and all that sort of thing. But
so if the if you're doing touring in winter, what parts of the country were you in at that point in time?
The south.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we were in New Mexico and West Texas, which we thought, oh, you know, it's desert. It's going to be the warmest part of the country.
Well, cold at night.
Yeah.
It was the warmest part of the country. It was also the coldest winter on record last year.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
So, you know, it was 40, somewhere between about 40 and 60 during the day. If we got lucky, it would get up to 60.
Yeah.
But definitely down to, like, you know, 22 at night.
And yeah, that's amazing. And so you guys were camping out, I assume, for at least part of this coldness.
Yeah, for most of it. Okay. And it was tough because not only is it cold, it gets dark at like 3.
Right.
So, you know, you have to get, we prefer not to ride at night. So we get all our riding in by 1, make a rush to set up camp, and then eat, and then clean up. And then you're in the tent for like, I don't know, 6 hours, waiting to fall asleep, freezing your butt off.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, you sit up in a tent, there's only so long you can sit up in a tent and read in the pitch black and the cold, you know, so you're asleep by like 6, 7 or something. And then, you know, you somehow have to figure out how to sleep for like 14 hours because you don't want right. to wake up at 3 a.m. because yeah. that's the coldest time of night. Kind of
extend your body clock just to, yeah. just right. to clock out for longer.
Yeah, so, that was tough.
During the winter, how many of your days would you spend camping and how many would you spend being like hosted by a friend or something? And then how does that number change more during a warm month?
I think during the winter, we're pretty much in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of forced to camp. I mean, I think we maybe only had like 5 days in the indoors, like during that stretch.
Yeah, it's hard.
Like throughout West Texas.
We had a few homestays that were, you know, mainly in the bigger cities, Las Cruces and, you know, Carlsbad, that sort of thing. But yeah, most of the place was, you know, middle of nowhere. So it was just us camped out.
Yeah, there wasn't a real choice. Like, even if we yeah. wanted to throw money at a motel or hotel, there just wasn't
anything no. in there. Yeah, and then, you know, but in contrast, like, by the time we got up to the East Coast, especially the Northeast, it's so dense up
right.
there.
There's just people everywhere.
You know, on one hand, you know, it was almost hard to find a place to camp. And on the other side, it got to a point where we knew so many people. You know, friends of friends, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody's friend's mom that, you know, was reading the blog or something. And, yeah. You know, so we had a nice stretch of, you know, 2 months towards the end of the trip where I think we camped one night.
Okay.
So it was, I mean, it really changed, you know, by it, between those two regions.
Yeah. Yeah. Population density is really interesting. It's mm-hmm. the same sort of thing like touring bands. I remember I was reading a book that talked about kind of strategies if you were trying to make it in the music business. And they always said, you know, live on the East Coast or live somewhere in the Midwest. But, the West Coast is a terrible place to make it for yourself as a band because the cities are so far apart.
Yeah,
so right. I'd imagine, I mean, a band at least has the advantage of being in a van and being able to drive like, to right. a habited city place or something yes. yeah. at night. So I can imagine even more so if you're just on your bicycles. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there are vast expanses out there.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we went through a stretch between Carlsbad, New Mexico and Del Rio, Texas. It was about 3 weeks that we were on the road, and we didn't pass one what you would call a normal grocery store.
Wow!
Just to give you a sense of like how desolate and sort of
the mini mart attached to a gas station, and that's it.
You got it. A couple of, you know, like the small
and
little
a lot of corn nuts, huh?
Yeah, small market of the tiny little
the
town.
The ranch
but
or the Santa Fe?
Yeah. Yeah. So, in a situation like that, where do you find your food? Like, did you
from the mini mart?
Yeah.
Did you guys dumpster dive much?
There weren't any dumpsters really.
Along with the people missing, so were the dumpsters.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like
the dumpster in the middle of nowhere.
We just got really good at cooking canned food. I mean, canned beans, yeah. canned tomatoes, canned yeah. chicken,
chili, pasta. You know, those things that yeah. you can carry for forever and. You know.
I mean, you couldn't buy a fresh vegetable in some places if you had like all the money in the world.
Sure.
It just wasn't available.
Yeah, not a thing. I mean,
or
it's
fresh
winter.
Meat sometimes yeah. too. So,
yeah. Are either of you guys vegetarian, vegan, or
no?
That's probably makes it a lot easier in a situation
I think
like
so.
That.
Yeah.
So, I think, gosh, I mean, there's so many things I want to ask you right now, but
I'd like to know. How did you guys pass the time when during those long, like, oh God, we can't fall asleep already, like, do you have ebooks or do you carry the weight of real books? Do you audiobooks? Board games?
We got really into cribbage.
Nice, yes, yeah. Board games are good.
We carried, yeah, some mini dominoes, cribbage. Occasionally, we'd fire up the computer and watch, you know, episodes of Dexter or Flight of the Conchords.
Nice, nice, yeah.
That's true entertainment right there.
Yeah. Yeah, games on the iPod, iPhone. Yeah. We did carry some actual paper books with us that we would swap out, and we'd sit up and read those.
Yeah.
I'd imagine you probably became quite contemplative at times, too. You probably, like, you know,
had a lot of time to think.
Time to journal and time to kind of figure out all the problems of the world.
Yeah.
Did you come up with anything?
Well, you know, when you're out on the road in the middle of nowhere, you figure out everything that's wrong, and you figure out exactly how to solve it, and then as soon as you get into civilization at all, it vanishes.
Oh, shit, never mind.
Yeah.
The static of other people, probably.
Right. You get into town, it's like, oh, I just want to eat.
And that's the... Seriously.
Where's the pizza?
Do you guys have any idea of how many calories you would burn in a typical day? Or of how much you could eat, maybe.
A lot.
Yeah. Like it would depend on, you know, the terrain, what the weather conditions are. I mean, if we hit a day where we were just battling headwinds all day, I mean, we literally, you couldn't eat enough food. It just, you know, your stomach just wasn't big enough to consume all the calories you
burned.
I think I saw a food calculator once where you can punch in, you know, the weight of your bike and your gear and the average speed that you were trying to accomplish, and I put in rough numbers. I think it said that we had to eat about between 4,000 to 6,000 calories a day.
My goodness, that's pretty intense.
Yeah,
that's enough to feed like 6 small boys that are always running around and pulling each other's hair and that sort of thing. So that's intense.
Yeah.
So you guys stayed with some people, and you said some of them were just friends of friends, people that you. Like, you know, your mom's friend, I think you had mentioned. And I think warm showers made an appearance on your blog not too long ago. Is that something you guys made use of as well, right?
Yeah, we did warm showers. And
warmshowers.org, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is it's not what it sounds like. It's a place.
It's safe.
Yeah. Safe for work, even. It's a place where people can make themselves available to host traveling cyclists, and it's cyclist dedicated. So
it's like couch surfing, but for bike tourists.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very fine pointed couch surfing for a very specific purpose. But yeah, we have used that several times, and it's a fantastic service. What were your experiences like with that? Did you guys have some good hosts?
We used it mostly. In the East Coast, and the experience
in the South,
and it was pretty positive. But we also stayed with lots of blog readers, which is pretty amazing because you know people would hear about us and that we're coming through town, and we get invites to stay with all these random people and families. And I mean, just the amount of like generosity and kindness we saw, it was just blew our minds.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, for example, this one. Time just still blows me away. It's like we had some readers in Seattle who happened to be out of town in Chicago, but you know they were big fans of our site, and they said, "Well, you know, we're out of town, but you can still stay at our house. Just pick up the keys from our friend."
That's pretty
great. These people that we never met, that you know we never met in person, and they just gave us full access to their house and said, "You know, you can stay as long as you like."
That's amazing.
We stayed with another great couple in Berkeley, and. We got there right before they left to go to dinner, and they had already had plans and stuff. And he told us later that that she was, you know, once they left and everything, she had sort of turned to him and been like, you know, are you sure it's okay for us to, you know, just leave them in the house and everything and stuff? And he was realizing that, you know, he'd been reading the site for so long that he felt like he already knew us. He could totally trust us and everything and stuff. And he was like, yeah, it's totally cool. So
I suppose if anything goes wrong, like he knows where you're going. Yeah. Waypoints on the map.
It's pretty hard to steal a TV on a bicycle. So.
But that was like a whole kind of funny phenomena in itself because we met readers that were reading our blog before we even left. So they knew our full story.
Yeah.
So we'd meet them and then we'd start to tell them the anecdote and they're like, oh, we know that. We read that like last week. So at first it was this strange kind of imbalance of information because like some people we stayed with knew so much about us, but we didn't know anything about them.
You have to save some good stories for those people.
Yeah. Well, it also ended up being good because then, you know, we got to turn the tables. So then we could ask questions about, okay, well, so what's your story? Who are you? And what's important to you? And you know, and then it sort of like evens out a little bit more and we're, you know.
Yeah.
That's
fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, we're pretty close to a breaking point, so maybe I'll have you cue up the thing of me.
That's right.
And thank you, Brandon. Your nonverbal cues were fantastic there.
Oh, thank you.
This is a song from a band that we've played before, the Carrier Pigeons. They're from here in Portland. The album is called Unfinished Business. It's actually just an EP because there's not a full album's worth of songs. But the song is called The Realists. You can find them on the internet at myspace.com/thecarrierpigeons. And we'll be back right after they're done.
She says she'll have no great disappointments if she has no expectations. And if you never love, tell me, what can you lose? Always give and never be a taker. Depend on someone and you'll miss them later. In the end, we must all fill our own shoes. Tell me your name, because you and me were so the same now. The beauty in ocean. You can't go blind if you've got no vision. Don't drink and your glass will always be full. It's said you can't stop the things that happen, but if you're smart, you'll learn how to avoid them. Just don't expect to get some kind of a miracle. Tell me your name, because you and me, we're so the same now. Leave me alone, I think the people like you are better off on our own. Smiles and evasive eyes, you let your heart slowly fossilize, doing nothing while you sit home and wait for a sign. Nothing goes wrong because you make no plans, you make no choices, saying it's all in God's hands. But being selfish is human, getting hurt is divine. Would you be mine? I think we'd get along just fine now. Push me away, I know exactly what you're going to say.
All right, we're back after a jovial and awesome break. We were just talking about public transit, so maybe we should head back and capture some of that for the tape and for you, the loyal listener. So you guys were talking about getting to Yosemite from Long Beach by public transit.
Yeah, on our trip, we met up with some friends in Yosemite Valley, and my birthday was coming up, so you know I wanted to be back in Long Beach, you know, by the time my birthday came around.
Right.
So we decided to take public transit back from, you know, basically the foot of like Half Dome back to Long Beach, California. And we pieced it together, you know, without ever, you know, driving. You know, there's a bus that goes from Yosemite Valley to Merced. It's called the YARTS, Yosemite Area Rapid Transit. And from Merced, we took the Amtrak.
The San Joaquin line. And it goes all the way south to Bakersfield.
Okay.
In California.
And then from there, we took the Amtrak bus from Bakersfield straight to Long Beach. And one of the great things about Amtrak in California is as long as the train just runs within the state, you can throw your bike on board without having to box it, which is...
That's pretty fantastic.
It is.
Yeah.
So anywhere in California at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
As long as it's within the boundaries of California.
Right.
Yeah. And Amtrak actually has a pamphlet that talks about doing bike trips using Amtrak buses and trains. And whenever we did tours that included the Amtrak connections, we'd always carry that along just in case.
Yeah.
You know, we ran into a conductor or a driver that didn't know about those rules.
Mm-hmm. It was really convenient for us being in Long Beach because it was a great way to get out of the big sprawling LA mess in order to get out into the countryside. We could just hop on. Take a lot
of the stress out of fighting traffic.
And yeah, instead of riding 50 miles of, you know, suburbia and everything, yeah, just hop on Amtrak, get out of the country.
How many targets do you have to pass to get out of
it? Got it.
Yeah, the train and bike is just such a great combination. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot more prevalent before in the 50s, but it's been kind of lost. If you go on YouTube, there's this great video put out by the British Transportation Alliance called search a cyclist special on YouTube, and it shows this great train in the 50s. You know, all the people to hop on in London, they take the train out to the countryside. There's a train just for bikes, and then you know, people to hop off and do these great tours, hop back on the train back in the city center.
And of course, it's, you know, this is British, so everybody's super civilized. They're drinking tea on the train, they're stopping for beer in the middle of their ride.
Talking about
you know?
The Queen and so on.
Exactly.
I mean, it looks like a tweed dress.
Everybody's wearing tweed.
So if I go to the YouTube, what do I type in?
Cyclist special.
Cyclist special. That's awesome. Thank you. Yeah.
That sounds pretty exciting. That's the sort of thing that, man, like really the past could be better than the present almost. I wanted to just briefly touch on, you guys said you kind of sold a lot of things or got rid of a lot of stuff as you were planning to move out. So this was kind of like jumping into it, like all the way in, like over your waders, kind of just, with no way back. No, it wasn't just going out for a weekend. It was kind of going out with the intent for this to be a lifestyle. So,
right.
How did you make the decision on like what to get rid of and what to store or keep with friends? Or,
well, we decided to get rid of everything because we didn't want to have to pay for a storage unit.
Okay,
we didn't. You know, we had a lot of stuff. We didn't want to deal with it. We didn't want to think, you know, we didn't want to be off on the road somewhere and know that it was sitting somewhere waiting for us at some point to come back and reclaim it,
where
and put it in
involved.
Another house somewhere. And, you know, when we started really thinking about it and going through everything, we were like, you know what? At some point in the future, when we settle down again, surely they will still be making plates and sheets and towels
indeed,
and bookcases and couches. Right. Surely we will be able to find these things again. So,
and I assume the things you had were not heirloom type things. I mean,
most of them, you know, yeah.
There's the special plate from grandma, but
yeah. No, a lot of our stuff was hand-me-downs. So, yeah, we went through everything we saved, you know, the things that had special value. So, you know, and like Russ put into storage a whole lot of his negatives and photos from when he used to do black and white darkroom photography.
Yeah. And that's the sort of thing you can't replace. Like, that's the stuff that you probably, I mean, yeah, there's no good thing except to kind of find a place to store that. But
exactly. Right. So our respective parents took in what few boxes we wanted to hang on to.
There's a real liberating process.
Yeah, for sure. I've actually been kind of in the process of getting rid of a bunch of my own things, just because they're taking up space and I don't use them. But it's amazing the feeling of just getting out. And what did you feel like maybe like before and after? Like, what did you see?
What was funny was we didn't see ourselves as stuff people, like, you know. But once you start pulling things out of storage and the closet and the cupboards, it's like you realize how much stuff you actually have.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like it's a lot like the subconscious. You know, you only use maybe 10%. You know, every single day, so it doesn't seem like there's that much. But then once you dig into storage, then, you know, you see all this other stuff that you're not using.
Right. A lot of gray matter there.
Yeah. One of the first things that we did was we just emptied everything out of all of the cupboards, and it was like, holy crap, you know? And so we went through, we had like almost 40 wine glasses. We were like, we don't drink wine.
Yeah.
Why do we have these, you know?
Any guesses on where those came from?
I think they were hand-me-downs, you know? So that was one of the first things that we did, and it was really kind of nice to get rid of everything. It was physically a lot more challenging than we would have expected.
Yeah.
Like, to actually be responsible about the ways in which we were getting rid of things, to recycle the things that could be recycled, to find new homes for things. You know, a lot of, like, we tried to find, you know, people that wanted to actually own and read all of the gazillions of books that we had, and then when, you know, the remainders we took to the library and, you know, donated them to the library, sort of thing. And that sort of being responsible for your stuff adds this whole other layer, and which makes it more difficult. You feel better about the way that you're getting rid of it all, but it makes it a little bit harder. And there definitely was a point at which, you know, we just kind of stopped caring. We just wanted to put it all in the middle of the room and light it all on fire. Just get rid of it all.
The fire freedom of liberation.
Yes,
sort of,
you got it.
Yeah. That's pretty great. So you kept your bikes. You talked a little bit about your gear and the stuff, but what kind of actual bicycles do you guys ride?
We both have Sterling Long Haul Truckers.
Oh, I've heard good things about those.
Yeah, they're pretty good. we got the frames, just a frame, so we could build them up how, you know, we like them. Mine has 26-inch wheels, and I set it up with drop bars. And, you know, Laura's is, which one?
Mine's a 700C, and it has sort of arc style, you know, kind of flat mountain bar, bike-ish kind of bars. You know,
but we've
got friction shifters, but, you know, and
yeah, we decided to go with friction just because it was a lot less hassle.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to constantly worry about the indexing.
Because the indexing can get off, right? Like, if cables stretch or that sort of thing, you kind of end up not having shifters anymore.
Yeah, and if, let's say you break a shifter, which could occur. Like, a Brifter is like, you know, a couple $100. Another friction shifter, you could get them for as cheap as $15.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, the thing that really informed our gear decision was that it had to be easy to find and be cheap.
There we go.
Or less expensive.
Yeah.
Not cheap in quality, but like, or, you know, a good quality, but it's not going to break the bank.
Sure.
And something that would last a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, for example, we both have flat pedals.
Okay.
Just because we don't have to worry about cleats wearing out.
Yeah.
And if, or the pedal malfunctioning. You know, if you go into a small town and you go to the bike shop, chances are they're not going to have your specific, like, cleat pedal configuration.
You're not going to be able to just click into a new one right away.
Yeah,
right.
But let's say, you know, you crash or something, your pedal's wrecked. You know, any department store you run into in the middle of nowhere is going to have flat pedals.
Just flat block pedals, whatever. Yeah. You had written an article, Russ, on that, I think, right? Just recently, if I'm not mistaken, just about someone saying, you've got the wrong pedals. And I remember reading that and just thinking, yes, this guy has it right. Because for so long, I just thought, like, why do you need racing? Why do you need to be tied to your machine?
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah, and that was really informed because, like, during our travels, we'd meet other touring couples, and you know, what would happen is, you know, generally it would be the guy that's trying to get his you know, girlfriend or spouse into bike touring, and he'd be really persistent about, oh, you have to be clipped in, it'll make you faster and more efficient and everything. And sometimes
more power from the upstroke,
right? Yeah, you know, while you're carrying 150 pounds, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what would happen is the other partner, you know, might not be completely comfortable with it, and then, you know, they'd have a tough time, and then they end up hating, you know, the whole bike touring experience.
Yeah.
The first time she falls over, it's done. She doesn't ever want to get on that bike again.
Exactly.
And I was thinking, it's like, that's such a silly thing to lose that, you know, that love affair with bike touring just because of a pedal or a piece of equipment.
Right, when you could easily have a different setup configuration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And be perfectly happy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
You notice the little 5-year-olds, when they set them up with the training wheels, they don't give them clipless.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though. So thank you so much. We'll I should put a special link to that story as well, as well as just the general link to your site, because I was really excited about that. Cool. And it's not that, I mean, clipless probably has its place on the racetrack. But, yeah, but that was an insight. I was just curious, as far as, like, I mean, preparing to leave for a long time, I'm sure you guys had, you know, a thriving social network of friends in Long Beach and people you knew and everything. How did you prepare kind of to leave your scene, and what was it like when you were gone? Like, did you have to deal with loneliness or anything like that?
That's a tough question. You know, I think by the time we left, we were excited about leaving. We were ready and everything. So you know, we didn't feel weird about sort of leaving all of our friends and sort of leaving this other life that we had. But, you know, it definitely was tough. I mean, it was sad. You have this whole network, and you have, you know, we had a group of friends that we would meet every Friday night, and we'd go have happy hour with them. And it was such a great way to sort of wind down the week. You know, how's everybody doing?
Yeah.
You know, and we'd have, you know, upwards of 12, 15 people that would come out sometimes. It was great. And so to sort of leave that behind is kind of tough. And you get off and, you know, you take off on the road, and you sort of have to create new social situations.
Yeah.
And it took us, I think, a little while to figure out, you know, how to do that, especially after we passed through Long Beach the partway through the trip and headed off into the desert.
Oh, right.
When you're in the middle of nowhere, and then you really start realizing, you know, how social we all are, and, you know, and stuff. So we'd strike up conversations with the guy at the mini mart, and, you know, this sort of thing. So you have somebody to talk to.
You become that crazy talkative person.
You're kind of looking for places just to find, like, any sort of social human connection.
Yeah, that. Yeah. But I mean, that's when we also realize kind of how, like, Facebook has made our trip different.
Yeah.
Because we had followers that started, you know, they'd comment, and, you know, we'd ask questions and they'd answer. So even though we were, you know, kind of physically alone, we always felt like we were being kind of watched over by our readers, and that we were still interacting with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's nice, because it seems like at that point you're not out there all alone. Like, you've got people that are very interested in what you're doing.
Yeah,
they're just not there with you.
Yeah, there are people rooting for you. Mm-hmm. But the whole social network thing was really the toughest thing to let go.
Yeah.
I think. Mm-hmm. And we're still kind of we're still figuring it out.
And you know, one of the things we did was we had a big going away party before we left.
Yeah.
And you know, and that was great fun. You know, it was just an evening of everybody we knew coming out and having some beers and some food. It was sort of potluck style, and and that was great. And because then it was like, you know, giving due to this, you know, the last however many years we had been there, and all these people that we knew, and sort of, you know, having this opportunity to really say goodbye and not just sort of slink out the door, you know?
Right?
So
you're making a grand exit rather than a small
right.
one.
Having
right.
the blessing of your friends, exactly. like, hey, we're gonna do our own stuff right now, yeah. so y'all just keep it real. But like, exactly. yeah, we are for you, man. yeah. Like that feels really good.
Yeah,
it
does.
Yeah. Yeah, at the same token, though, we had kind of a strange homecoming the second time around. You know, we went back recently to visit, and you know, we'd been gone for like a year and a half, and it was long enough for people to kind of emotionally reshuffle the deck.
Right.
You know, so you try to get together with people and some were like a little evasive or, you know, they didn't want to make that kind of emotional investment again.
Sure.
Because, you know, you were gone or you're not.
Yeah. We're only going to be in town for like 2 days. So, you know, it's don't get too attached because then they're going to leave again. So it's interesting. We found that, you know, like friends that we were, you know, really close with, we had a hard time reconnecting with, but you know, friends that we weren't quite as close with, we had the opportunity to, you know, get together with, have some beers and everything. So
I don't know, it's all
very fascinating, really.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I imagine it's kind of a delving into the great subconscious and maybe even the conscious mind, but like the stuff that you kind of stuff to the back in normal everyday life probably comes right to the forefront.
And that's
one of the hidden costs of like travel.
Yeah.
You know, people think it's just great and dandy. And it's like a party the whole time.
Yeah, but, for sure. You know,
but, you know, there's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of, you know, loneliness. And there's a lot of unexpected things like this. Like, usually when you read a travel novel, people go off and have an adventure. But you never read about them coming back home or if they can actually go home.
That's right.
So right now, it's like, you know, we've been pretty good about blogging this experience because it's part and parcel of the whole trip as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think, Laura, you wrote an article just recently about kind of an experience where you kind of had just the breakdown and the not liking it anymore sort of thing, like the magic was gone from the experience. And
well, that was sort of that was a story from when we were on the road from back in Texas. Was sort of you know, my lowest point of traveling. And you know, it was sort of an experience of you know, I think everybody when they go off and do something that's so sort of epic feeling, you know, you will inevitably have a moment where it just all feels impossibly hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but most people don't want to admit to that.
For sure.
Because it's really hard on your ego. Yeah. And for a long time, I didn't want to either. And stuff. And it sort of, I think several months later, somebody had asked a question of, you know, was there ever a point at which you wanted to just quit?
Yeah.
You know, after one of our presentations, and it was just sort of like enough time had passed that I was like, yeah, actually, you know, I kind of did. I had this whole like tantrum on the side of the road.
For
and,
sure.
And so, you know, it took me a while to sort of find the words, but I'm glad that I did. Cause I think that needs to be out there, you know, cause it's not all sunshine and roses all the time.
It reminds me of the Barbara Savage book in which they had the several experiences. Like one was, I think was in North Dakota where they come to like almost fisticuffs where it's just like, well, I'm going this way.
Yeah.
I'm going this way. And I hate you. Fuck you too. And it's just all over. But
I think Dumb and Dumber had a scene like that too, actually, for the record.
You had an extra pair of gloves this whole time. But yeah, that's actually last summer I took a trip without Adele because Adele, you had to work, and it was sad. I was excited because I got to go, but like third night of the trip, I slept in a marsh with mosquitoes hovering around and right next to the Empire Builder train tracks, and
nice.
And the Empire Builder and freight trains were all going by all night, and I didn't sleep very well, and I didn't have the right stuff. I didn't have a tent because I thought I was just going to sleep under the stars and it would be all romantic. And,
right.
and I woke up the next morning and a beer in my bucket had exploded and all my stuff smelled like and then I was like
was
bicycling.
Too.
I was bicycling towards the Tri-Cities through like agro-industrial, what have you, and earwigs had crawled into all my stuff. That's right. Thanks for reminding me. And I just remember I cried like a baby, like out there in the middle with no one to see me, and just like So it's crazy what your head does when you're out there.
Yeah. If it makes you feel any better, we did have one night of camping where we got up the next morning and I had. Towards the second half of the trip, all of our food went in one duffel that went on my back rack.
I don't like where this is going.
I had put it up, you know, sort of hung it or put it up on a ledge to keep it away from whatever critters might be there. But when I got it down in the morning, it was crawling with ants. just
that's the worst.
Like, you can't see the food, you can only see the ants.
Yeah.
She like the moving.
I was
back.
Like, I think I threw out the jar of jam because they were just, you know, anything that was sweet, you know, it's just
so sad. They leave you like the hardtack, right? Like all the stuff you don't really want to eat.
Right, exactly.
Oh man, that's rough.
Yeah.
What else happened on the road that was maybe like bad experience, like big problems?
Well, tell us your worst story.
Tell us the shit of the shit. Like, what was the worst that ever happened?
Well,
to you?
That like the most probably like kind of like the most emotionally dramatic was we thought we were going to die by missile fire at one point.
Oh my goodness. that's
top
worse that. Than I thought.
All future guests, top that.
Where was this?
This was in White Sands, New Mexico, and it's like this. You know, this national park, White Sands, white gypsum sands, 40-foot you know, sand dunes that look like they're made out of snow.
Right.
But it's right next to Air Force Base. And there's one road that goes through, and every week they close the road down because they do missile testing.
Oh, so it's like some days it's clear and some days it's not.
Yeah, I mean, and when you get there, we checked into the campsite, you know, the ranger was there, and they give you two pamphlets. And one is, you know, leave no trace behind ethics, you know, like, you know, pick up after your poop kind of stuff.
Right, right.
And the other one was like a picture book of all the unexploded ordnance that sometimes falls within the boundaries. And there's a big...
It was great because the woman that was giving us all this information was like, if you come across something, just let us know. The military comes out real quick.
Right. Like this payload could fall on you.
Yes.
Right.
So they sent us off with those two things, and it has a primitive campsite, and there's supposedly a trail, quote unquote trail, that we're going to follow, and we tried to follow it, but it went up and over the sand dunes, literally.
Uh-huh.
So imagine pushing, you know, like a 150 pound bike over 40 foot sand dunes.
My goodness,
it just wasn't happening. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
terrible.
And it was getting dark, and they say, you know, you want to pitch camp by dark, otherwise you'll get lost because everything looks the same. So we pitched camp in this area that we're not supposed to. It's like this interdunal area that wasn't the official campsite.
Because they also make you sign this thing that says, I swear I will only camp in the designated area, you know, under penalty of U.S. law or something like this, you know.
Well, aren't to blame if you blow yourself up.
Right.
So we made this decision. It's like, okay, they probably would much prefer us to just camp illegally and not get lost and have this whole rescue situation.
Yeah.
So we set up camp, and then, you know, we even hear the ranger, like, over a couple of dunes, you know, telling everyone to leave the park. It's closing. And then, you know, we're just about to fall asleep, and then we hear these two big explosions. I'm like, oh, shit.
Oh, man.
And then I open up the tent. I look out, and there's just, like, these streaks of light shooting up through the sky. You know? And mind you, this is the winter. We're camping on sand. It's, like, freezing.
Yeah,
it's, like, sleeping
it's
on
like
concrete.
20 degrees outside.
Right. So, you know, in our heads, it's like the choice is to either run around in the freezing cold and try to maybe dodge what's flying through the air, or stay
in the dark,
which you know you're not going to see coming,
right?
Yeah,
or stay in the tent.
The idea of a missile,
right. Or stay in the tent where it's warm. So we opted to stay in the tent.
You just gotta pray that nothing happens.
Yeah, I mean, like, what do you do? I mean, you know, all these like just random thoughts run through your head. One of them was like, "Oh, maybe we should stay in Long Beach."
Russ always loves it because the story. Because as soon as we heard those explosions, and I like sat bolt upright, the first thing out of my mouth was, "Are we gonna die?" And we were kind of like, I don't know, actually.
Yeah,
can't say with certainty.
Maybe today, maybe not.
Yeah.
That's when you take inventory of everything. But eventually, it quieted down. And after a couple of minutes, you know, nothing fell on us, obviously.
Right. You're here to tell the tale.
Yeah.
So.
Right. And then we ended up hearing, like, talking and laughing over the sand dunes.
Oh.
And that's when it kind of clicked in Laura's head that she'd overheard that there might be a group of students camping in a campsite. So we put, you know, one-on-one together. It was like, okay, it's probably them shooting, you know, fireworks or something.
Bottle rockets.
Those are just bottle rockets.
Yeah.
You know, at that moment, like, everything added up. You know,
the
ordnance you're not supposed to touch.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Camping illegally and all this stuff. So.
And it's all just kind of happening at once.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I imagine you probably had like equal parts like gratitude that they were only things that couldn't kill you,
right?
Yes.
And then just like unmitigatable rage
at
the kids that were just out having
time. We also had another experience where we were camping somewhere where it was actual like heavy artillery. Like we pulled over and then we heard what sounded like someone shooting shotguns, like a shotgun every like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You're like, surely you can't do this all night. So it got dark and sure enough, you kept hearing the sound in the distance. And I finally looked up where we were camping on the iPhone and not too far away was the Yuma Proving Grounds.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know? So it was just over the hill, and they were, you know, popping off some big rounds.
That's also White Sands?
Yeah.
No, that was in Arizona.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But yeah, there's so much, like, out in the West, Arizona, New Mexico, there's so much just empty land that's really easy to free camp, but sometimes when you're free camping, you're not really sure where you are, who's going to stumble across you.
And what they do at any given hour on that
land. Right, exactly.
And shooting shotguns off their back porch.
So there's this sort of like, you know, am I actually going to be able to sleep tonight, there free camping, you know?
So did, how much free camping did you do? Like, is it something, I assume in the West it's easy to do, but...
Yeah, in the West it's easy to do. We did a fair amount going across Arizona, New Mexico, West Texas. Not Texas. Texas doesn't really have any public land. It's all privately owned.
Okay.
Arizona.
Don't reinforce my stereotype of Texas.
Arizona, New Mexico, definitely. Cause there's just so much nothingness and nobody really cares. But once you get east of Texas, it's just so dense. It's really hard to find spaces. And we also discovered that a lot of places, like, surprisingly, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, North Carolina have a lot of really great, like, legitimate public campgrounds.
Yeah.
And so we were like, you know what, this is kind of okay. You know, hey, I get a shower at the end of the day. And, you know, they were usually by some sort of water feature, so Russ could go fishing. And
there you go.
Yeah, in Louisiana, you could get Wi-Fi from your tent.
Really?
They really invested in their their campgrounds. Yeah. Just because it's called
Brandon, this would be great for you.
No kidding.
I mean, it's called the sportsman's paradise because so many people are into hunting and fishing, and you know, so you can, you know, you go in the bathroom, it's like air conditioned during the middle of the summer. So it's crazy.
I guess you
have to use the toilet. I'm just going, I'm just hanging out here. It smells horrible.
Well, it's funny. I was actually laughing at one point when we were in Louisiana, because when we were in New Mexico and we would camp, there were nights where it was so cold that I wanted to sleep in the bathroom to be warmer. And then when we were in Louisiana, I just wanted to hang out in the bathroom because it was cooler. Because it was like 95 degrees in Louisiana.
Yeah, for real.
That's amazing.
You guys have talked about using the iPhone to get an idea of where you're at. I know a lot of folks out there who are into this sort of stuff are probably, they have some sort of iOS or Android smartphone. What apps did you guys find useful? Are there like ways you can have a map offline? Or I know there's a handful of them. I don't know what's good.
Yeah. Well, we used a couple. One of them to track our general trajectory was this app called Track My Tour.
Okay.
And you could drop waypoints and, you know, track your tour and take pictures and geotag it. And what was nice about that was it wasn't a real-time GPS, so it didn't drain the batteries. It only, you know, used the satellites.
Only when it was active.
Yeah. So that's a good way to kind of generally track your tour. As far as, like, daily use, I downloaded a couple knot-tying apps because we'd pitched a tarp. You know, and you know how to make a trekker's hitch, you know, adjustable top line hitch.
Because this is the sort of thing you don't really learn in everyday life anymore.
Right.
And another app that we use was there's a couple like stargazing apps that could, you know, just for entertainment, like see what the stars were.
Yeah.
Or you're there.
And the locavore.
Yeah. And locavore, you could you know, hit your location. It would tell you where the farmers markets were and what was in season.
That's really cool.
It's called locavore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, locavore.
As far as like navigation, we'd use Google Maps a lot, and then what we started doing kind of towards the end of the trip, once we'd gotten lost enough times, is we would actually take a screenshot of the Google Map on the iPhone, and then it's saved into your photos. Even if you were in the middle of nowhere and you didn't have signal, you know, so if we had Wi-Fi in the morning but knew we weren't going to have signal later on, that's what we would do.
You could still kind of save that information.
Right.
How do you take a screenshot on an iDevice?
For the iPhone, you hold down the little square button and then the power button. And you'll hear a little click and see a flash.
Oh, there you go.
But we use it. Actually, another great tip is using the camera on your phone. For example, during the West Coast, you know, a bunch of people had you know, different maps that we didn't have.
Sure.
So we'd all lay the maps out on the table, and everyone would take pictures of each other's maps.
Yeah.
Or, for example, you know, you enter like a national park area and say they have a map of the campgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Take a picture of that and use that as a reference.
We should assert that any of the maps that you took pictures of course, were in the Creative Commons or in the public domain. Yes, absolutely. And you, of course, would not have taken photos of anything that was copyrighted or otherwise.
Nor would you have sold photos of said maps.
Of course. That's not something you would do. But
I'm curious how you guys powered any, like your laptop or your camera or iPhone.
It's actually, we get asked that a lot, and it's the most like anticlimactic advice, but it's the most
giant piles of batteries.
No,
we use
an extension cord.
We use an extension cord. Because if you think about it, when you're camping, where's the power? It's in the bathroom.
Right.
So we just run a 15-foot extension cord in the bathroom. It would, you know, break out into three outlets, and we could plug in the camera, the phone, you know, the iPhone.
Yeah.
Or every time we stopped at, like, a gas station, you know, wherever there's a soda machine, just
sure.
go run it behind the soda machine. And we kind of, you know, what I like to call opportunistic charging.
Yes.
So leave that stuff
hit and
handy.
Run.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Charge and run.
Exactly.
Well, we also got really, just really good at, you know, looking always where's our plug, you know, where can we charge? And so even if it was like 5 minutes while we're, you know, running into the store or
right.
something, you
that's
know,
5 minutes of charge,
right? And then you don't have to worry about it later. Exactly.
But we also had like an external battery pack that could charge the iPhone up to three mm-hmm. times or any other mini USB devices.
Okay.
So we'd carry that with us. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you guys rolled without an actual laptop computer, right?
No, we had a laptop.
You had a laptop. Yeah. Okay. So that was, okay, something you would use from time to time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was heavy.
All right, yeah. Seriously. But it's probably worth it. I mean, it's the sort of thing that, I mean, it's indispensable in our daily lives when we stay put, and I can imagine so much more so if you're going from place to place.
Well,
so.
And how do you update a blog?
Right, yeah. Right. You're not going to jab your fingers at the screen of an iPhone.
Yeah.
For, you know. I mean, exactly. It works for the small stuff, but yeah. Twitter, yes. Blogs, no.
Right.
Yeah.
But, is there anything else that surprised you guys? Like, anything that maybe you expected to be one way and was another? Or what were the most startling revelations of being out on the road together?
Texas was a big surprise. You know, we had lots of kind of preconceived notions of what it would be like to ride there, like you were saying.
Yeah, like... you know, people would warn us in advance about Texas. You know, we'd talk to people who were heading into Texas, and we get this, oh, just wait, you know, kind of snarky responses and stuff. So we have to.
They're going to judge you as
you got it.
City liberals on your fancy pants bicycle.
We were half expecting to roll across the border and, you know, be met with yahoos and pickup trucks and shotguns. You know, and it turned out to not be the case at all. I mean, everybody was just super nice.
Yeah, and Texas is just, it's epic and it's beautiful riding. There's so many roads. There's so many farm-to-market roads that if you don't want to be on the main road, you don't ever have to. I think it's got, like, the most roads in any state compared to...
Yeah, per capita. Know. Yeah,
that's pretty nice. That just seems like, I mean, it's something that we don't have a lot here in the Northwest because so much of the country is hilly. And
we're lumpy.
Yeah, lumpy. And the roads are all made of dirt and mud and sticks. Yeah. So.
And Texas, it's also, like, so geographically diverse. Mm-hmm. Like, far west Texas is, you know, kind of deserty...
all high desert.
Oil derricks, and that's about it. There.
Not really. West Texas, wasn't really oil country, but
We went down to Big Bend, and you have like
country.
These big, you have these big epic mountains and everything. And then when you get into Central Texas, like around Hill Country, it's like these big green rolling hills. You think you're like in the middle of Europe.
Yeah.
And then you get XP backgrounds.
Yeah.
With these old German and Polish settlements and.
Yeah. That's also amazing. Surprising. Is that it's just nothing that fits the stereotype.
Yeah. We ended up spending 3 months in Texas, you know, in part because it's such a huge state, but
right.
in part
just
because
how long it takes to get across it.
But just, you know, in part because it was just such a neat place to be. You know, we spent a lot more time in different spots across Texas than we would have thought that we would have because we just really enjoyed it.
And they've got, like, such a great, like, state park system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's pretty great.
They do, actually. We were impressed. The Texas State Park System was one of the most innovative that we've seen. They actually had a program designed to get people interested in camping.
Yeah.
So if, like, it was designed for families. So say you're a family, you live in a city, you have no idea how to camp or what goes into camping or what you might need.
Yeah.
But you think, hey, this might be kind of fun. So they actually started a program where you sign up, you pay or whatever it is, you show up on Saturday morning, you don't have to bring a thing with you.
Wow.
They provide the tents, the sleeping bags, they, you know,
fishing poles,
so they
you know,
you
wood
everything.
For the campfire, food, the whole works. They teach you everything you need to know. You spend a night out there, you know, you have, you know, big roaring campfire, you know, share stories and everything. And And they, you know, everybody leaves, and the park system has, you know, 30 new park users. Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant. It's
what they taught me about drug dealers. Yeah. Your first one's free.
Absolutely.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
So we probably should wrap up here pretty soon. It's getting late. You guys will need to get home, and we probably are going to have to go to bed too. But we should talk. Last thing I just was interested in was what advice would you give to aspiring bike tourists, either for the short term or just to people that might want to follow in your footsteps and do what you've done?
It's going to sound really cheesy, but just to do it. I mean, it's like I think, you know, and we've all, you know, pray this also, but you kind of get overwhelmed with all the gear choices and everything. And you know, a lot of people, you know, build up this mentality like, oh, I can't tour until I have this bike or these panniers or this camping gear.
Sure.
And it just, it's a roadblock. It prevents them from doing it.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes it's better just to go out and do it and see what it's about and get excited about it with like imperfect gear.
Uh-huh.
Because at least you're on the road and then it kind of you know, just inspires you to do it more.
Yeah.
And I would say just do it however you need to do it. You know, I mean, there's sort of... There's this idea that not only do you have to have the perfect gear, but when you go bike touring, it has to be this like epic and super hardcore adventure. And
sure.
It's like, you know what? Our first bike tour, we stayed in a hotel and we went wine tasting. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know,
that
do
sounds
it.
Awesome.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't carry a whole lot of gear. You know, had a bed to sleep in every night. You know, went to a restaurant for dinner, sort of thing. Bread and cheese. You know, picnic. You know, and. So it doesn't matter. You don't have to be free camping in the desert in 20-degree weather, you know, thinking missiles are falling on you. You can do it, you know, however you want to do it.
Yeah.
And,
it doesn't have to be an extreme sport. You know, bike touring is supposed to be pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
We found that it's fun to pair, you know, other extracurriculars with bike touring. Like you could do a beer tour and visit different, you know, breweries in the Willamette Valley. Our tour... The latter half became a fly fishing tour.
Nice. So
I try to hit all the different rivers with trout in it. So it's fun to pair it with other interests, you know, to get your partner, you know, more interested in it or something.
Yeah. That's good advice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Russ and Laura, for coming in and doing a session with us. And I should be sure to pimp all of your various online presences. We've got pathlesspedaled.com. It's pathlesspedaled.com. It's where you guys have your stories from the trip that you've done, all kinds of information, beautiful photography, and as well as merchandise, which you can buy, and you should, because they're good.
If you'd like your portrait taken or any of your merchandise photographed.
Russ, you've got a photography site. That's russroca.com, R-O-C-A.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, you've got metalwork available at tangerinetreehouse.com.
Got it.
And what was the other Epicurean Cyclist? That's your own blog, Russ?
Yeah, it's another bike touring kind of review site that kind of reviews quirky, fun stuff, like 2D bike stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So that's hard to spell, so I'll just put a link on the website for that. go and check that out and give them some love because they're good people. Before we wrap up, we do have the beers from Hopworks that we were drinking this entire time. So the 7-Grain Stout, first of all. That's one of my personal favorites, but Laura, what did you think?
I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah.
It's got a nice dark roasty flavor, but not too heavy. It's good.
Yeah. It's got the espresso grounds, I think, that they brew it with, which it gives it its fantastic flavor, and that's something I particularly appreciate. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
And the other one was the IPA from Hopworks. Also a good beer.
Yeah, it's good. Hoppy, citrusy, medium-bodied, you know, good on the palate.
Yeah.
Quaffable. For being as hoppy as it is.
Yeah, very quaffable.
Kind of like you have to hold it in your mouth for a minute before you can...
Right.
That's right.
Rock, how was it having a good beer?
You know, it was wonderfully enjoyable.
Really?
There's the poor man's...
I'm so proud of you.
There's the poor man's route to happiness, which I usually take because I'm cheap, and sometimes I am actually legitimately poor. And
that'll make me feel like shit.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, I woke up the other day with a headache, and I couldn't quite understand why my head still hurt. And then I realized it was because of the low grade malt liquor that I purchased the night before. So actions do have consequences. But I mean, you know, it's nice to, as they say, kill the fatted calf every now and again. So, let's wrap up. Brandon, if you want to cue that ending music for us, you can find us on the internet at thesprocket.podbean.com. Send us feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks by email. thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com is how you can send that to us. Or you can call and leave us a message. We'll play your voice on our program. It's 503-847-9774. Big thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. And you can find him on the internet at myspace.com/RyanJLane. So we will say adieu.
Hasta luego.
Au revoir. See you soon.
Ciao.
And thank you so much for joining us on the Sprocket Podcast. We will see you next week. Goodbye.